Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 9th. Representative Portman moves approval of the minutes dated March 4th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have one bill on our agenda for the committee today. The committee is scheduled to go till 2:30. Well, the clock hasn't moved ahead, so I'm confused. That's why we're starting really early. We are scheduled to go till 2:30. Which one? All right. In the event that we go past the allotted time for the committee, we'll be in room 200 at 6:30 p.m. So it would certainly be the chair's preference to wrap up by 2:30, but in the event that we're not able to facilitate that, then we'll be back at 6:30 p.m., room 200. So with that, I call on Representative Neuberger. Representative Neuberger to House File 333.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I move my bill, House File 333, to the next available stop pending the actions of this committee. And with that, House File 333, as most of us are aware, addresses the 111D plan that the federal government, the EPA, is putting together here for the entire country. This bill is an important bill for this state. It's very significant. In one way, unlike the Affordable Care Act, which affected many Americans, this bill, not this bill, but 111D, the EPA will affect every American. Anyone that uses electricity anywhere in the country, 111D is going to affect. We had really good testimony last week, kind of got into the weeds and into the mechanics of 111D. And I know that we're busy as members, and I know that there's so many things going on. But we need to really make sure that we understand what 111D is and what it does. I'm going to just discuss it very, very, very briefly, so that we all have a good idea of what we're talking about here today. 111D is the EPA's plan of action to reduce CO2 emissions in every state. Each state must create its own plan, its own unique plan, as to how it will comply with the EPA's orders. Each state has been ranked on how much carbon dioxide it produces, it emits. According to the MPCA, I believe it was about a month ago when we had them come in, Minnesota was in the middle of the pack of the 50 states. We were about number 26 for how much CO2 we produce. With the proposed rules, and with the current CO2 reductions, Minnesota is number 10 and for how much we have to eliminate. As you know, our current number is 41%. And for me, I know that there have been members in this committee that have questioned if we're in the middle of the pack for how much we produce, why are we in the top 10 for how much we have to cut? That has been a concern that's been expressed by members on both sides of the aisle, and we have yet to really get a concrete answer on that. The 111D plan is real simple if you want to look at it as to how it functions. The federal government tells the EPA to create this 111D plan and make it work. The EPA tells the states. The state agencies then create the individual plans. The plan in Minnesota will go to the governor. The plan, if it's okayed, we'll then go from there to the EPA, and the deal is done. Once the deal is set, once the plan is accepted according to the rules, the proposed rules that I have read, and I have spent the last 2 weeks reading these, and according to my research, once the plan is accepted, the deal is done, there's no changing it. You're locked in. In my opinion, I think that the 111D plan is... It really passes the buck of liability. I believe this is leadership from the rear, in my opinion. What it does is if there are any problems. So you have the federal government coming to the states saying, this is what you must do. You must create your plan. So when the state goes ahead and creates its unique plan, if there are any problems at all, much of the literature that I have read states that the federal government is primarily off the hook for liability because it's the state's unique plan that they're adhering to. So if you have power outages or economic devastation or grid problems, the federal government's going to say, wait a minute, it wasn't our plan, that was your unique plan, so you're the one that's liable. I have a big issue with that. Much of the research that I've read has really highlighted that, and they call that leadership from the rear. I think that also would be the case here with what we're doing. If we don't do something about this, my bill, House File 333, brings the approval of this plan to the state legislature. It doesn't say anything about the particulars of the plan. What it says is that whatever the plan is, it's got to come back to us, the elected representatives, for final approval before we can send it off to the governor and before it goes off to the EPA and we are locked into a deal that's done. Right now, if we don't pass House File 333, we'll completely bypass the legislature, and that element of accountability will be gone. Um, 111D requires the states use, at least at this point in time with the proposed rules, 111D requires that the states construct their plans on four basic building blocks. And I'm going to be really easy on this, real simple. The first building block, very simply put, says that power generating units, power plants, either coal or gas, need to increase, they have to burn hotter. Generally, they want them to increase their output by 6%. Now, as all of you know, I've got the biggest power plant in the Midwest in my district, and I've had many conversations with the men and the women that work there, the people that run that plant, and this is an insult to them. This is very insulting to anyone that runs a power plant. This is what they do for a living. They know how to make power. They know how to make maximum efficiencies. And for the federal government just to arbitrarily scratch its head and say, oh, you know what? You guys can just burn 6% hotter because we think you can. That's like telling a brain surgeon what to do, or an attorney when you're not an attorney what to do, or any pick your profession. So that's very insulting to the people that work in the power plants. And for the gas plants, the research that I've read, for the gas plants, if gas plants increase their production by 6%, many of them will decrease their lifespan because they're burning hotter, they're burning past what they were designed to do. It's the old adage of putting jet fuel in your lawnmower. Your lawnmower will run really fast, it'll chop up everything in your yard, but after about an hour, you're going to burn up the engine. Simple analogy, but there's some truth to that. So the first building block is just, hey, tell the plants to burn hotter. Second building block is to reduce the CO2 from power units right now by using other units that use less CO2. So, for example, if you have a coal power plant, and they say, well, it produces a certain amount of CO2, you're going to reduce your coal plants by building more gas plants because gas plants create less CO2. That's building block number two, simply put. Building block number three says, you know what, reduce your CO2 just by using power generating units that create no CO2. None. And the fourth building block is called demand side reduction, where we decrease the demand of power that the public needs. There's been a lot of issues with that. I brought this up last week. One of the things that came up, and I believe it's been defeated at this point, was the tailoring rule. But basically, simply put, that part of the reducing the overall power usage is could be equated to rationing of power. That's one potential component of building block number four. So those are the four building blocks. And again, what I've said here in the past, and if we look through all of the literature, it says that the EPA, every single page of the proposed rules, almost every single page, as I went through it, really emphasizes the fact that states have the flexibility to create their own plans. I'm concerned with that. because a comment came up last week that the more you say something, the more you, just because they, you say a state has flexibility, the more you say it doesn't make it more true. And in my opinion, I think that also goes back to the whole argument of the federal government trying to shirk away from its responsibility and leaving the buck with the states, should there be any problems. So now we've got this 111D plan that everyone in the country is going to be affected by. Every state's going to have to adhere to this. And there's a timeline for this, and we discussed this quite significantly and in-depth at our last hearing on this. The final rules are supposed to be put out by the EPA anywhere between, they were supposed to come out of June of this year. And the plan is that once the final rules come out, every state has 1 year to create its own plan. That's it, 12 months, 12 calendar months to create its own plan. As we know, the EPA has been running into problems with that, and they're going to be pushing back. They pushed back the date as to when the final rules for all of us to obey are going to be published, and they're saying sometime this summer. So it could be as late as September if you go by the actual calendar, where the beginning of fall is September 21st. Technically, they could go till September 20th. So the deadline for us for completed plans, for us to come up with a plan, would be June 30th of 16. If we want to get an extension for that, it would be June 30th of 17. And as we heard from the MPCA commissioner last week, his own words is that he intends to file an extension to the deadline. So that would give us 2 years. Also, we would be able to possibly enter into a joint partnership with other states. If we did, that would give us until June 30th of 18. There are many elements to the plans that the states have to follow. They're in the rules. They're extensive. So at this point, people are asking, well, they're saying, well, if we don't adopt the plan, will the EPA force a boilerplate plan on us? In the literature that I've read and the rules that I've read, that is the EPA's intention. However, I think that we're gonna explore that here a little bit as we go into the committee hearing. Real quickly, our neighbors, so Minnesota has to reduce its CO2 by 41%, Wisconsin's 34, South Dakota's 35, North Dakota's 11, Iowa is 16. I'm concerned about that. The commissioner wanted us to enter into a joint relationship with other states, but given our antagonistic posture towards particularly North Dakota, towards 111D and carbon emissions, I find it difficult that other states would be interested in joining with us, especially since we're 41% and no one's even close to us for how much we have to reduce. So basically, there's a little bit more I'm going to touch on, but I will do so with my closing comments. So what House File 333 simply does is it says, regardless of what the plan is, it comes back to the legislature and we vote to approve it, because we have to have some accountability. We're the ones that are ultimately accountable to every citizen in this state, not a small handful of agency workers. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will stand for questions, or I will entertain other guest speakers.
Representative Neuberger moves that House File 333 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Neuberger, do you have any testifiers that you wish to call first before we go to those who requested testimony?
No, at this time I don't. I do have testifiers that are here, but I'm going to defer the order of testifiers to the discretion of the Chair.
Okay. Members, then what we'll do is we'll go through the public testimony portion of the bill, let everyone get there. First of all, is there anyone who is not paid to be here who has come here to testify in this committee? Because you go to the front of the line. Okay. All right. So then, good. So what we'll do is we'll just go through all our testifiers, and we'll have questions at the end of that. First on the list, I have Mr. Johnson from the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, and next is Ms. Hamilton from Fresh Energy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. I'm here to testify in support of the bill. As I testified last week on Rule 111D, all of the generation owned by electric co-ops in Minnesota is located outside of the state. And so, excuse me, our G&Ts are currently working with other states on their implementation plans. We do have concerns, however, that the state of Minnesota will use the state implementation planning process as a as a way of passing policy that they can't get through the legislature. We think it'd be a good idea to have policymakers in both of the House and the Senate offering input into the plan and also eventually approving the plan to make sure that ratepayers in Minnesota are protected as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Hamill, our members, we're going to take questions when everyone's testified afterwards. That way we make sure we hear from everyone who's here. So, Mr. Johnson, you'll still be around?
Thank you.
Ms. Hamilton, welcome to the committee. And next on the list will be Legislative Director for the MPCA. Is it Greta Gauthier?
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Just a simple question for the testifiers, just to identify whether they're part of the stakeholders groups that are trying to come up with, for each and every one of them, whether it's the co-ops or minis or fresh energy or anybody else.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the commission committee. My name is Jay Drake Hamilton. I'm with Fresh Energy, and I'm a member of the stakeholder group that the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Commerce have jointly convened over the last two-plus years, and that is open to everyone. Thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for last week's informational hearing, Mr. Chair and committee members, which was a great way for, and thanks to the bill author for helping us all understand this important legislation. We know we're going to need to cut carbon. We don't know exactly, and we won't know until midsummer, what the final rule coming out of the Environmental Protection Agency looks like. But we do know that it will entail some cutting carbon. And so for a smart state like Minnesota that has already started and is already on the pathway, as Mr. Thornton testified, to cutting carbon quite cost effectively, we have a sense that there are only so many ways you can do this that are going to be both cost effective and achieve other goals for the state of Minnesota. Economic goals, job goals, growing of our native industries here in Minnesota. We know furthermore that going forward, we don't know the answer looking back on what exactly will count in the final rule. But we do know going forward that everything the state of Minnesota does will count. And so when we look at renewable energy and energy efficiency, those building blocks of the four that the author mentioned, Representative Neuberger mentioned, are the ones that we have lots of capacity to fill in Minnesota. And those are the building blocks that we should explore. And we should evaluate as a state whether we're getting cost-effective reductions, how many we're getting, and where they occur in Minnesota. And that is the process that the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Commerce have already started. We know that these cost-effective reductions, specializing in renewable energy and efficiency, are going to be in the right thing to do for Minnesota. And we like, at Fresh Energy, we like, and the other stakeholders have all expressed that they like the fact that Minnesota is in the driver's seat and is paying attention to cost, reliability, and environmental or carbon results. So those are the three results that we're looking for. As we develop our own unique plan, we are opposed to this particular legislation because we think a stakeholder process where everyone is welcome, all voices will be heard, and where the state agency has the capability to draw on analysis specific to Minnesota that will tell us what the cost is and what the results are, is a better path forward for Minnesota. Two important considerations. One is that at the stakeholder process to date, we've had the benefit of having numerous expert staff from MISO, and so if you're interested in, which is responsible for reliability, so if you're interested in looking at what Minnesota's plan will do for reliability of in Minnesota of electricity, you want to have those folks at the table. I don't know that they would routinely be part of lobbying the Minnesota legislature if that were the alternative path. And secondly, I would just point out that I think there is a very real possibility, because it's stated in the statute, that if a state does not submit a plan that's acceptable to the Environmental Protection Agency, that there will be a federal plan that will be imposed on that state or those states. I haven't heard anyone testify that they think that a federal plan for a state that's already a leader like Minnesota is going to be better than a state plan for Minnesota. In fact, I find it instructive to think about what that federal plan has been called. The acronym is FIP, so it stands for Federal Implementation Plan. So whether we really want to get FIPped is a question going forward for all of us, and I look forward to testimony from other witnesses who are opposed to this particular plan going forward. Thank you very much, and I'll be here for questions later.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. And let the record show the chair is against FIPping. Ms. Gauthier and Mr. Colt. I saw what you did there. That's funny, yeah. Ms. Gauthier and then Mr. Kolash, and I apologize if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, but is Frank Kolash here as well?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frank Kolash, first of all, my name is Greta Gauthier, but Gauthier is correct in French. In America, we say Gauthier. But Greta Gauthier, I'm with the Pollution Control Agency. I'm the legislative director. Frank Kolash is here. He's our program person for this area to answer any in-depth questions that the committee members may have. Thanks for this opportunity to testify on House File 333. The rule is the MPCA has, as has been alluded to already, a process underway, which we began shortly after the U.S. EPA announced that they were going forward with this rule. We have assembled a group, a working group, of 137 individuals representing 64 different organizations in a public, transparent process, and we're working very closely with partners at the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. EPA's final plan, which is due out sometime late summer, will drive what we must put together for compliance, and Minnesota cannot change, as has been alluded, what our target is going to be. But our work at MPCA, as the delegated authority of the US EPA in Minnesota, is to develop a plan with input from all that meets our goal and also puts what's best for Minnesota first. That's why we've reached out so extensively to create this large group to come together. It's quite a challenge to formulate this plan, and quite frankly, we need people who have extensive experience and deep knowledge on our energy industry, the best and the brightest in the field, if you will, Mr. Chairman. We need those folks. We need everybody who, all stakeholder and industry experts, to come together and devise solutions that will work the best for our state. With this existing process already in place, we feel that this bill's insertion of a legislative process on top of that seems duplicative. It also raises concerns as to the separation of powers. Executing the law, and in this case, it's the Clean Power Plan, is an executive branch function. That said, we do believe the bigger impact of this bill may be that it would discourage people or serve as a disincentive for people to participate in the process that we already have going on with those 137 individuals representing 64 different organizations. Some organizations may not want to expend the time and dollars necessary for their expert staff to participate if they know that the process is going to end up in the legislature and their work may or may not bear fruition. Another related concern is timeliness. If we do not submit our plan on time, then the EPA has the authority to give us a plan or impose a plan on us, and that default plan would not be tailor-made to Minnesota, which we believe our process will create a plan that is. Adding on the requirement to obtain legislative approval will increase the timeline for this, we believe. And the Commissioner Thornton, Assistant Commissioner Thornton, who I apologize is not here today, he is in Washington meeting with folks at EPA on this very subject. He did say that he expected to have an extension, or the likelihood was strong for an extension, but of course no one's made that decision yet. We believe the best results will come out of a deliberative, iterative process in which experts and interested parties participate. We think that will take longer than the legislature will have the time to do in the course of a regular session. At this point, we don't even have the final regulation from the Environmental Protection Agency in front of us. We feel that the committee can wait and see what the EPA does to see how our stakeholder process is going in a year, or if we do intend end up asking for an extension 2017, and consider legislation at those points as well. Meanwhile, we invite all of you to roll up your sleeves and attend our meetings and work together with the group that we've assembled to come up with a plan that's going to work well for Minnesota, meet everybody's needs, be cost-effective, and meet the needs and the requirements of the EPA. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be happy, I and Frank would be happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Director. We're going to finish up our public testimony, and then we'll come to member questions. Thank you very much. Mr. Ryan, and then on deck is Mr. Cashin. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Ryan. I'm with the United Steelworkers, and I urge you to oppose House File 333. This bill would severely limit Minnesota's flexibility in determining how our state complies with federal regulations to limit carbon pollution from existing power plants. This bill would cause unnecessary gridlock and put our state at risk for the imposition of a federal implementation plan, or a FIP as referred to. For more than 40 years, the United Steelworkers has worked with states and the federal government to help shape energy and environmental policies and rules. We've done this to ensure that the safety and long-term health of not only our members and their communities, but to also help ensure the competitiveness in the industries that they work for. Our union will be actively engaging with the state-level stakeholders to help make sure that state plans are reasonable and achievable and preserve and create jobs. As such, there are several measures that must be incorporated into a state implementation plan, or SIP. We believe that a SIP must include focused investment in advanced coal, manufacturing, and industrial energy efficiency, including combined heat and power, or cogeneration. SIP must also leverage the resources of agencies, states, cities, and industry. Investment states make as a result of the proposed CPP should be major initiatives that couple efficiency with community redevelopment. Finally, a SIP must ensure coordination of existing transition assistance measures. It is essential that well-funded and consistent policies to support the transition of impacted workers and communities are developed alongside of a state plan. We must develop a reasonable and achievable rule that preserves and creates jobs. Unfortunately, House File 333 would lead to unnecessary gridlock and would severely put Minnesota at risk for a federally imposed plan, and I urge you to vote no on House File 333. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Cashin and Mr. Lugtug is on deck.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Mike Cashin with Minnesota Power, and I am here to speak in favor of House File 333. And it's a complex dynamic we have going with the Clean Power Plan. I'm sure you would all appreciate after you were briefed in hearing last week. I wasn't able to be in the audience on that. But the primary thing I would like to have you consider when I call out for favoring of this rule is that we are addressing a very unique federal regulation under the Clean Power Plan, in that in its structure under Section 111D, EPA recognizes that the building blocks that it's calling on the states to deliver could well fall outside of the realm of federal authority. And through this process and the setting of guidelines is looking for states to bring forward initiatives that could be responsive to the targets that are being set for each of the states, and in that process offer their authority in a proposal to EPA such that EPA would then receive the state implementation plan, approve it, and by that process turn it into a federally enforceable standard. So that is relatively unique, and I've been involved with regulatory and legislative matters for quite a long time, and that in addition to just addressing environmental dynamics, the Clean Power Plan crosses over and seeks to change how we do energy in the delivery of serving our electricity customers. And in the process of doing that, my observation as a member of the stakeholder group that's meeting in state is that there is a lot of education that needs to be done amongst ourselves and how things work. It is complex, and a lot of the things that perhaps people would like to do could very well fall out of the realm of what we're enabled to do, either through authority that's assigned to these various agencies. And it's a bit of a wild card in terms of what we know and what we don't know. In that realm, I would like to applaud what the MPCA, Department of Commerce, and others have been doing in the stakeholder process, and it's been a very good opportunity to learn and understand what the needs are. And we've talked about the different points of view on how things should proceed. Minnesota Power was visiting with EPA and sharing input to stakeholders before the proposal was out, and we outlined the realm of the types of things that we thought would be workable. And we found that when the proposal came out, that there were incompatibilities with that input that we gave. Consequently, as we see this rule moving forward, we've been working with the stakeholder group to identify the kinds of concerns that we have, what types of things we can do, can't do. You heard about getting credit for the early action that Minnesota has delivered. Consequently, we now have a long laundry list of stakeholder comments that have gone to EPA, and they are in process of considering them. And I heard mention that David Thornton's out visiting with EPA now, sharing things, and a lot of the other stakeholders I'm aware have also done that. We don't know what is going to be brought into the final rule. It's something that EPA had said was going to be, as had been mentioned earlier, brought forward in June. Now it is the summer of 2015, and then it's also announced that we're going to do a synchronization of new unit and modified retrofit units and existing units, along with a federal implementation fallback, so that we have four bundles that are going to be released around the same time frame. The FIP is going to be in a proposed status, but the other items are going to be targeted to be into a final status. So we're anticipating quite a lot is going to be brought forward. At this point, I have a few items that I'm especially concerned about that kind of carry over from that process. If you look at the four building blocks right out of the gate in block one, we have a concern that the efficiency improvements that EPA laid out were based on national assessment of what coal units can achieve. They did a statistical break, and then they assigned for most of the states a one-size-fits-all target. So they didn't really look at what Minnesota has done already and what we brought forward. So my concern is that right out of the gate, the good deeds we've been doing in Minnesota as being a progressive state, running a tight efficiency program with our utilities, we have to take on a 6% burden to make reductions out of that area or substitute other measures. In block two, we have a problem where the goal is to operate natural gas combined cycle units in the states more. And that plant is on duty cycle purpose to provide for reliability in our electric system. So in essence, what we're going to be doing is taking coal units that were intended to operate more base load and put them in a position where they're going to swap places for reliability service with natural gas. But we don't own those units. At the same time, we have, as a utility, accountability for preserving that reliability. So if we don't own the units that are going to substitute for the ones we do have control over, and we're also going to have a constraint on what we can put out from our units that are left over, we have unanswered questions in that area as well. You're well aware of the Minnesota Renewable Portfolio Standard, which gets addressed under the Block 3. We've done good progress there, and EPA is indicating that any surplus that Minnesota has done beyond a 15% target could be made available to benefit the other targets and meet those bogeys. But they've also indicated that they may consider assigning a state potential value that would pretty much wipe out that surplus. They've also indicated, as they set the targets as they were proposed, that they're going to put a boundary dynamic on Minnesota's borders. So we as a utility, with all of the renewable development we've done in North Dakota, are going to need to bring forward some way of resolving Minnesota renewables that were built in another state. That's a legal issue. We're not sure how it's going to be addressed. And then finally, the conservation portions. We've been a leader in Minnesota Power and meeting the Minnesota conservation objectives. And I'm familiar with measures in the early 2000s where we accomplished 10% cumulative conservation improvement amongst our customers. But the way the Clean Power Plan was proposed is it restarts the slate, makes us look at new reductions, and leaves us wondering if we're going to have a saturation or diminishing returns dynamic where we're going to be compelled to try to reach out in the same area. So what I'm looking at is the prospect of a legislative approval of the bundle that's brought forward from our working group process would bring value by helping the process of whatever is brought forward being at a higher level of acceptance and legal implementability as we wrap up our submittal to EPA. And I would hope that we wouldn't be in a situation where providing a state legislative step would be a tantamount to driving a FIP. I believe that could be avoided as this is structured and should be avoided. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lugtog, and then Mr. Arata is on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lauren Lugtog, Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. And my company does support Representative Neuberger's bill. The SIP, we feel, should come to the legislature for approval. First thing I want to say is we have a very collaborative relationship with the MPCA. We've worked on many projects over the years, and they've been very helpful in some of our legislative efforts, and we've appreciated that very much. We are involved in the stakeholder process, and so we're one of 30 to 50 parties who are involved in that process, and we do think that is a good way to start to develop a plan and to build a plan. I can understand why the PCA may not want to bring it here. It gets very complicated over here for 5 months. But on the other hand, for those of us who are utility stakeholders, especially if we own coal plants in the state of Minnesota, you might say that there are many folks who are at the table studying the menu, but there are only a few of us who are on the menu. So, Mr. Chair, I didn't get to speak on this bill last week, so I hope you'll indulge me for just a couple of extra minutes if I can address the blocks, but I'm going to do it in a slightly different manner. This is my 15th session as a lobbyist, and I'm the son of a teacher, and I always try to, people ask me, what do I do here? And I say, I'm a teacher. That's an honorable profession. I teach from my client's perspective. And so I've developed a metaphor for blocks 1 through 4 that may make the subject matter slightly more approachable for you. What we have here is a situation where the EPA is putting coal states on a diet. And the diet that we're going to be put on requires us to lose 40%, which is quite a bit for those of you who have been on diets before. And I apologize, I'm using sort of male reference pounds here, because that's the part that I'm familiar with that. We have to get from 250 pounds down to 150 pounds. If you're familiar with the body mass index, I recently, last July, I had my physical, my annual physical. I'm 6'2", and I weighed in at 205. And a month or 6 weeks later, I got a letter from my health care provider's wellness organization, and they informed me that I am overweight. I hadn't thought of myself as being overweight. After all, I'm the same height as Teddy Bridgewater, and he weighs about 5 pounds more than I do, and he's being accused of being too skinny to play in the NFL. But my body mass index...
Lockdogs, that is the absolute worst analogy I have heard in 11 years in the legislature.
I didn't play football.
Please continue. My apologies. Please continue with your testimony.
So my body mass index is about 25. When you get to 30, 25, by the way, is overweight. 30 is considered to be obese. If you're going to get down, if you're going to lose 40% from your body mass index, we're currently at about 30 as a state. We have a BMI of 30, and we need to get down by 40%. We have to get down to a BMI of 18, which puts us right on the border of being underweight. So how are we going to do that? EPA developed something they called the preferred plan for each affected state, and our preferred plan, I've developed the four building blocks as ways to get from 250 pounds to 150. Building block one, the heat rate reduction, this is kind of like liposuction. This is a direct impact on the subject at hand, and that's in our case, it's our body. We have to get down to 225 pounds according to building block one. The problem with that is that as Mr. Cashin pointed out, those of us who are in the program, we have outages every 2 to 5 years, and every time we have an outage, we're doing something to improve our heat rate. We have for 15 or 20 years been doing liposuction. So we can't get down to 225 from 250 by using liposuction. I'm going to skip to building block three, which is renewables. Plan for renewables is we're going to have to run every day. Everyone has to run 3 miles a day. The problem with this is that Minnesota's already been running 5 miles a day and for more than 10 years. But that's in the past, and the plan is forward-looking. Building block four, conservation, energy efficiency. This is aerobics. Everyone needs to do aerobics for at least 1 hour a day to get from 250 to 150. And again, Minnesota can say, but Minnesota already does aerobics for an hour a day. In fact, we've been doing aerobics for over 20 years, and we still weigh 250. But again, keep in mind, the proposed rule is forward-looking. The EPA doesn't care if we used to weigh 285 or 300. All they know is we weigh 250 today. I'm not defending them. I'm just explaining how the rule works. So now we get to the stakeholder process, which we think will be a good process. And it's very likely we would develop something like what you might call building blocks 5, 6, 7, and 8. I've been in Representative Hortman's office, and I've actually been in a lot of your offices. And we discussed the possibility that CO2 offsets, for example, might be a building block, and that's entirely possible. So that would be potentially a building block 5, 6, 7, or 8, or whatever building block we wanted to call it. Now, if I can back up just to one more part of the plan, building block 2. This is the redispatch of natural gas combined cycle to displace coal. Building block 2 only applies to you if you own a bicycle. If you don't own a bicycle, as North Dakota does not, you are not affected by building block 2. This building block, by the way, adds to your goals significantly. So if you don't have bicycles, or your neighbor doesn't have a bicycle that he or she can lend you, you don't have a building block 2 goal. So this will explain why North Dakota has such a reasonable goal compared to other states. South Dakota, on the other hand, has a more substantial goal than does Minnesota. And the reason for that is there's one coal plant, one person to lose weight, and there's one big, brand new, shiny bicycle there. And it barely ran in 2012, the baseline year. So the goal for South Dakota was set, assuming that that one combined cycle plant could displace Big Stone Plant, the plant that we operate and co-own with two other companies. So if we get to building blocks 5, 6, 7, and 8, I think that will come out of the stakeholder process, and that will be very helpful. If we do CO2 offsets, for example, that's kind of like you don't want to lose the weight, so you can hire your neighbors to lose weight for you. Farmers could grow no-till crops, or we could use ag, or you could use forestry, or those sorts of things. Now, the thing that's unique about all the other building blocks besides one, liposuction, is they all lie what we call outside the fence. Normally, when EPA proposes a rule, it's inside the fence. So when, for example, my company was affected by the proposed rule for regional haze, we're just now about 90% through a project at Big Stone Plant in South Dakota that's going to cost us $390 million. We could buy the technology off the shelf. That's why it's called inside the fence. Building blocks 2 through 4, and most likely the building blocks that may be added in the stakeholder process, would be outside the fence. That's why my company supports Representative Neuberger's bill. What we're doing here is we're developing broad energy policy for the state of Minnesota. The PCA will do a wonderful job with the DER in putting a plan together with all of the stakeholders involved. But in my company's opinion, it's the purview of the legislature. It won't be until 2 years from now, so it may be that Representative Mahoney is the chair of this committee, or Representative Fortman. I'll just say there's a 50-50 chance of something like that. No matter who is the chair or which party's in control, it should come to the legislature for review, in our opinion. Mr. Chair, that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So what I hear is that, like, a wind farm would be a rice cake, and Sherco would be like... No, it'd be like a heart attack burger, right? Is that what that I'm hearing? Thank you, Mr. Lockduck. Something like that. Mr. Arata and then Mr. Gerber.
What a juicy news.
Yeah.
Just plain good.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm not sure how to follow that. My name is Mark Arata. I'm the Central Region Vice President for the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. And took the liberty of spending my weekend doing up a PowerPoint for you all. And I wanted to bring a little bit, maybe more of kind of a wider perspective maybe than just Minnesota. And although I am here on behalf of ACE, we also are part of a coalition called the Partnership for a Better Energy Future, which is over 100 state and national associations. And the reason I bring up the partnership is because it has such members as the National Association of Home Builders, the oilseed producers, the California cotton growers, and the list goes on. And I bring that point up because this is not just an issue that is important to those of us who are involved in the energy sector, but it is a much broader issue than that. We've also brought to you today a study ACE did, commissioned NERA, an outfit in Massachusetts, to do a study of the Clean Power Plan. We have developed specifics for most states, and so we brought today the ACE impacts that have resulted as we've looked at that NERA study. There we go. So you all know about the basics, and the Clean Power Plan is just the beginning. The Clean Air Act regulates over 70 source categories. And once electric generating units are dealt with in the Clean Power Plan, then EPA will be moving on to other source categories. This all goes to the point that Mr. Lautag had made, that this is energy policy. Energy policy is appropriately set by the legislature and policymakers, and not through a bureaucratic process in a SIP forced upon a state by the EPA. So that is my main question to all of you today. Do you want energy policy set by the legislature as it has traditionally been done, and the power resides, yes, of course, working with the executive branch and others? And so that's why we think ultimately review of a SIP that's going to be submitted to come to the policymaking body, the representatives of the people of the state who are going to be very much affected by this, is an appropriate measure to take. We've heard a lot about the endangerment finding and what power has been granted the EPA or acknowledged to the EPA, and I wanted to clear that up a little bit because it does get mischaracterized in some instances. It was Massachusetts versus EPA that people like to refer to. And in that court case, the court was ordering EPA to provide a rationale for whether or not to make an endangerment determination. It did not say it had to make a determination. It did not say it had to make an affirmative determination or that it had to regulate greenhouse gases. It simply said, if you make an endangerment finding, you then have the authority. So pulling specifically from the case, in short, EPA has offered no reasoned explanation for its refusal to decide whether greenhouse gases cause or contribute to climate change. Its action was therefore arbitrary, capricious, or otherwise not in accordance with law. We need not and do not reach the question whether on remand EPA must make an endangerment finding or whether policy concerns can inform EPA's actions in the event that it makes such a finding. We only hold that the EPA must ground its reasons for action or inaction in the statute. And of course, that's how this is all going to play out, is through the interpretation of that statute and where we go from there. There is other language in the Clean Air Act that was cited in that case, but the court simply did not say you must and you have the absolute authority to regulate. You first must do that endangerment finding. By the way, that was based on automobiles as opposed to a greater case. Last summer in UARG versus EPA, when the court took up the tailoring rule, they issued this language, and I'm not going to read it. I'll let you read it. But it was a very strong warning. In our mind, we like to think of it as a cannonball as opposed to a spitball across the bow of the EPA ship. But they did, in an unusual case, use some pretty strong language warning the EPA about overreach. And I think if you talk to a lot of scholars, interestingly enough, one of the Professor Tribe out of Harvard, who is considered one of the leading constitutional scholars in the country and who was a professor, I believe, of President Obama's when he was in school, said that what the EPA is trying to do is not constitutional. And so this is going to come down ultimately to that question. Now, we all know about... What are you pushing here? Okay. Different than mine. We all know about the four building blocks. This is what the EPA has put in place, at least in their plan, if you take their data, what it may look like for Minnesota. In an interesting way, because you've heard a lot about the building blocks, the 6% on one and 70% capacity factor. Think about it, if you want to do another, to my own peril here, Mr. Chairman, another analogy. Think about being sent out to run a decathlon, and you have those 10 events, and the only way that you can win is by posting a personal best in every single of those 10 events. That's, in essence, what EPA has done with the Clean Power Plan. They have set out broad goals, not based on any state specifics, made some people would say very questioning decisions as to how you get into the detail, how they come up with the 6%. That's broken down into a 4% and a 2% based on efficiency, new technology, and how they run their plant. I believe the 4% was, well, we just think if we train operators better, they'll do a better job. That's basically what the 4% comes down to. So once you start to dig into the details, it's just not possible for the energy sector to do their career best in every category and think that that's a reasonable way to go about this and to reach that ultimate goal. Here are some of the impacts that our study shows on Minnesota, and we have done a lot of modeling. We are very careful in the kind of modeling we do and how we go about it. We use government data because we want to make sure that if it's coming from the EIA or the DOE or whoever, whatever the government source is, that it is data that is widely accepted and not just disputable because it was something that was created by an industry that was looking out for their own best interests. I'm not going to go ahead and read those. You can see that for yourself. But 15% annual increases is what our data is suggesting for the state of Minnesota. Now, there's lots of other opposition, and so while you look at potentially doing something here, and in this case, all we're saying is oversight of the plan, lots of other states have concerns as well. You can take a look at what's been happening last year and this year. If we move on and look at what states have actually submitted, in their comments, you can see 29 states across the country in their comments last fall said, EPA, you do not have the legal authority to do this. 30 said, you cannot regulate outside the fence. And another 28 states said that they should simply withdraw the proposal. Now, that's a strong statement by lots of states around the country. So it isn't just necessarily in Minnesota, but in states all over that are expressing strong concern for where this plan is going. Once again, it goes back to that premise that I think is most important is, who do you want setting energy policy for you for your state? Let's be very clear. This is not your mother's SIP, right? A normal SIP is go to the utility, take this piece of technology, bolt it onto that plant, and if it's a bag house, it will control for PM emissions. That's one kind of a SIP. That's the traditional SIP. Unprecedented in the 40 years of the Clean Air Act is EPA coming in to say you will go beyond the fence line and you will regulate well beyond just simply technology for a specific criteria pollutant under the NAAQS standards. And so that's why we're saying this is clearly energy policy and not simply an environmental issue with what we would say is a traditional SIP. But normally, you could say, let's leave that to the PUC. They can do that job. They can handle it. They can work with utilities and take care of this issue. This is far, far bigger than that. There have been lots of concerns about cost and reliability. One comment I wanted to make on that is American Electric Power out of Ohio. As you've heard, even though the goal is 2030, the vast, vast majority of reductions come in 2020. Well, during the polar vortex, interesting, since we live in a cold state, I don't know why we need a new name for just a really darn cold winter, but during the polar vortex, AEP had over 85% of its coal plants that are scheduled to retire in 2020 running to meet the demand. Now, you can't replace that in 5 years' time. So there are strong concerns about reliability issues under the current proposal. So when we look at kind of where we're headed from here, you can see that the power sector emissions from the United States are a small percent of global emissions. It is clearly understood that by 2030, both China and India will be emitting more greenhouse gases than the United States does. It's also interesting that back in the days of the Kyoto Protocol, I'm not aware of one country who actually signed the Kyoto Protocol who has met their obligation, the promise that they made under that document. Oh, by the way, the United States did not sign it. Had we, my understanding is that we would be below that emissions rate that would have, the U.S. would have had to have committed to. So we've done a significant job, and a lot of that credit goes to the states, what the states have done in energy policy. And you all know this energy policy has come from the states more so than from the federal government. It's probably a good thing in most of our minds as state legislators or former state legislators. So what do we get when all is said and done? Because the EPA sells this as a climate change plan, yet the benefits to the climate are insignificant at best. And in fact, in the several times that I have heard Gina McCarthy speak since this plan came out, she has never once led with climate benefits. It's always been other items on the agenda that they've used to try to show why this is a good thing. So it was mentioned about additional building blocks before. I have a fifth potential building block, and because this is a serious subject and we could use a little bit of levity, I'll bring that next slide up. And Mr. Chairman and members, the main point really is, who do you want setting energy policy? Where is that appropriate body? We believe it's in the legislatures, and we hope you will too. And if you want to try another building block and think there's a better way to go, then here's an alternative. It's probably not as fun as the bicycle or some of the things that were suggested earlier, but thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Arado. Will you be available later for questions as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will.
Thank you. Mr. Gerber. And this is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Okay, so sir, you'll be next. After Mr. Gerber, you'll be next. Is there anyone else? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for having me here today, and I'd like to go through a few brief points on behalf of our 2,300 members across the state. One of the things that I mentioned multiple times, and I believe I repeated, was how big of a deal this is. This is something that the largest changes we're going to see in energy policy, certainly in the last 50 years, and probably, hopefully, the largest change we ever see going forward. And so with that, I think it's really important, and I want to thank Representative Neuberger for bringing this idea forward about the legislature having the ability to work with the executive branch to talk about what we are going to do and how these changes we are going to make to meet EPA Rule 111D. This is going to have huge impacts across our economy. Specifically, I want to mention the impacts that will be felt by the large industrial customers, the backbone of our state's economy. According to EIA data, industrial customers have decreased their energy intensity by 45.5% since 1987. And I think that's a good thing. Our larger users are becoming more and more efficient. But the concern that we have among all businesses, but specifically in this case some of those larger customers, because they're energy intensive, they trade globally, so energy prices matter, is that it's estimated they will pay about one-third of the state implementation plan. And that's something to consider as we look forward. Who are going to pay these costs? It's going to be the citizens of Minnesota. That includes our residential customers, our small commercial customers, those small businesses, mom-and-pop shops, but also these large companies. And so we all have a stake in what happens here. The real concern among these customers is competitive energy. Unlike some of the other smaller mom-and-pop stores, which also are important, this would allow production to shift to other countries. There's something called emissions leakage, which is as the costs increase in one state, the production facilities and production capacity will shift to other states with a less intensive SIP or other countries. And what the concern will be there is that if they don't have these stringent environmental requirements that the U.S. does, as I've said before, carbon is a global pollutant. It doesn't matter if you emit a ton in Minnesota or in South Korea, in India, or in Africa. That ton of carbon has the same impact wherever it's emitted. And so if we start shifting the production facilities to places without these requirements, we really haven't impacted anything, and we've only hurt ourselves.
Mr. Gerber, you really need a new term besides that one.
Emissions. I promise I won't go into analogies, but maybe that was my
one. I would appreciate that, yeah.
Yeah. I won't talk about my BMI. And here's why I think this bill is important, and this is where I really wanted to go, is the emphasis on cost-effective implementation. And I heard a lot about this is going to cause gridlock and gum up the works, and I really don't believe that. I think, as I said in the last hearing, the PCA has done a really good job at reaching out to people. I think they'll do just as a good job reaching out to legislators, hearing what they want, hearing the concerns that Representative Metza might have on the Iron Range, or Representative Mahoney might have in the pipe fitters, or Representative Garofalo might have in his district. So I think that it's going to happen. I really do not believe in this theory that this is really just there to create gridlock. Other states have done this recently. Other states have required legislative approval of their SIPs for years and some of the other EPA requirements. So this is not something that's going to be new, and I think it will hopefully create a great long-lasting relationship between the legislature and the executive branch. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. You'll be around for questions at the completion of testimony.
Yes, Mr.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, I didn't hear the last stakeholder in the chamber say whether they were part of that.
Mr. Gerber, are you part of the stakeholder process?
Oh, yes, we are. Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think I said that last time, too. We have been involved, and we have...
Mr. Arata, how about you? Have you been involved in the stakeholder process? Just a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
No. Sure, we haven't represented there at least through December. We are not currently.
Okay, thank you. And sir, please come on down. And are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? All right, seeing none, after this gentleman, we will close the public comment portion of our committee, and then we'll move on to member statements and questions. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Fred Gercio, Burnsville, Minnesota. I'm a national advocate on mostly First and Second Amendment, and I have a unique knowledge about this. I used to call in the power industry. Matter of fact, Sherco has the power plant control system from Leeds and Northrop, and twice I was rated one of the best in the world, two different years in a row, shortly after joining them. I've read and watched what the EPA has done and the government has done in the war on coal. The United States has the best coal reserves in the world. Not only the largest quantity, but the best quality. And we have to be careful with power, because power is the lifeblood of our country. It's what the industry uses for fixed costs. It's almost as big as labor. And we have to be very careful in what we do and what we wish for. And I'm sorry to say that our federal government and our leader, Mr. Obama, and his administration, we've seen, what, 36 major scandals from the IRS and the EPA and the DOJ. We need to be very careful what we do and what we wish for. And it's great to say we want to clean up our environment and so forth, but we have some issues. And like I said, we have the best coal reserves in the world, and we're a few years away from saying we can't use coal. So I strongly suggest that we use that coal to our advantage. I'm going to tell a little story. When we built the Coolidge Dam, which is in the Pacific Northwest, the president at that time said these are shovel-ready jobs and we need them. We're coming out of a recessionary period. And they backed up the river and they messed up the salmon runs, and they tried to oblige the Indians for their burial grounds and things like that, and they actually started digging up the burial grounds so they could move them. But underneath those levels, there were more levels and more levels. So rather than dig up 15, they were now digging up 30 and 45 and then up to 60. So by that time, the waters were coming, and there were major problems. And the projects were dinged and dinged and dinged, as you can see. And the dam was too tall to do the salmon ladders and things like that. But right about that time, shortly afterwards, we had all this power, clean power, water power. What are we going to do with it? And you just can't keep backing it up. You got to produce it. And if you don't produce power in the region, it gets expensive to ship it. Right about that time, Pearl Harbor got bombed by the Japanese. And this immense amount of power was used for inductive power for making aluminum, and it's why Boeing's on the Pacific Northwest. And that's where all our planes came from. That's what allowed us to win the war. There's a really good PBS story on it, too, if you want to take a look. Power is a big deal. Also, I'd like to say that we've only built like 5 major power plants in the United States in the last probably 30 years. And the reason is they've been tied up by the EPA and the DOJ, and our wonderful administration has been caught on many times. When these big plants need to be built, there's environmental impacts, there's legal papers, there's a lot of documents they're putting forth. And the EPA and the DOJ were releasing them to the Greenpeace and the other types of green organizations. They've been caught a few times. So be careful what you do to the power plants. We need them. And then as far as the green power and things like that, when we have cloudy days or no wind, you need a plant that you can turn the switch and go on. And as I heard it said before, normally we base power nuclear and we cycle the coal. And this past summer I was up in one of my old stomping grounds up in North Dakota. Now the reason the North Dakota power plants are there, it was mine to mouth. They had lignite power plants there, and they would take the coal and feed them into power plants and then ship it here. And what happened in the 80s and the 90s, they forced them into making their power cleaner. So then they started shipping in coal from Wyoming and so forth, because cleaner coal and lowered their emissions. Well, what I was learned by talking to some of the people that I was visiting, the power plants up there for much of the year are idle. They're using wind power, and they're not even getting a full week's work. They're in part-time work. And again, once we get rid of the coal plants, you can't wish that the wind would come up or the light or the sun comes out. Okay, these are supplemental. But if you really want to make sure when you flip the switch, the light comes on, you need coal and nuclear. And as far as the rest of the world being a modern country, we're way behind on nuclear. Again, because all the projects get tied up and tied up and tied up, and you have to imagine what happens to projects like that when they get tied up for 5 to 10 years. The legal fees are immense.
Sir, I apologize for interrupting you. I just you're the last testifier before we go to public comments, and the bill before us today is whether we're going to have legislative approval or not of 111D. So if you could maybe hone your comments on just that portion of it before you wrap up. I don't want to cut you off, but at the same time,
what I want to get to is, you know, global warming was global warming, and now it's climate change. And what I've heard from the experts, and I predicted this 15 years ago, there's a 15-year cycle between the Pacific currents and the Atlantic currents. So I grew up in New England, and I remember back when I was a little kid that in the 70s, I was going out and shoveling 20 and 30-inch snowfalls. And the adults didn't want to do it. So at that time, I was in my single digits, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. And I was coming back with $200 in a day from shoveling driveways. Okay? So one of the things that I want to make sure that you guys consider are some of the scientists that aren't getting their words out that are saying bunk to global warming. And I put some of this on CD. But, for instance, scientists respond to Obama's administration national climate change assessment. The National Climate Assessment 2014 NCA is a masterpiece of marketing that shows for the first time the full capabilities of the Obama administration to spin scientific topic as they see fit without regard for the underlying facts, with hundreds of pages written by hundreds of captive scientists and marketing specialists. The administration presents their case for extreme climate change. And then when Fox had a tough time talking about climate change, I have some contacts there. I sent them a summary of a bunch of different stuff. Climate change reconsidered, plants and animal study. There's 1,000 pages, and it debunks the climate change. A large group of international scientists take issue with the United Nations IPCC claims of man-made climate change with CO2. Okay. Then the next one, 15 reasons why global warming is a pseudoscience.
So this is your one-minute warning to wrap things up. Okay. Thank you.
Cap and trade ripoff. You guys are familiar that in the 80s and 90s, we were working on carbon emissions and made them put stacked emission monitoring on the power plants. And then we actually introduced that we want to tax them for that. And if you don't, if you have clean emissions, you can sell your carbon tax credits. Countries that have done this are wishing they didn't. And there are 1,000 scientists that couldn't make it on there. And then we also have ABC, CBS, NBC went 1,300 days without letting these scientists have any voice. What I'm trying to get to is I believe legislation like this is important, and the reason the other states have, when you give absolute power, it corrupts. Obama's executive orders are corrupt. When we get the EPA, as large as it is, we corrupt. When we went to natural gas on our power plants to force them to get cleaned up, we had 250% increases in the cost of our natural gas, which got put right on the shoulders of the public here in Minnesota. We also had that
You're in favor of House File 333?
I mean, I think we should, and we should be slowing down what we're allowing. The EPA is basically trying to force regulations for power plants on one power plant that's a study that hasn't even been able to reach the rates they want to do.
Sir, we've reached the end of your time, so thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Okay. You'll be available for questions if members want to ask. Is that
sure.
correct? Thank you very much.
And I have two documents I'll put forward and about six more on a CD that I think everybody in the panel should have access to.
Okay, so usually what happens is we'll make copies of those. We'll probably scan them and email them to members if that's okay with you.
That's why I give them to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Are any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions. I have Hortman, Fabian, Baker, Simonson, and Scott. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a number of questions, but I would assume you'd like me to ask a couple, and then you can go to other people and then come back to me as time permits. First, my first question is for you on the motion of where the bill goes. I'm looking at the fiscal note, and I see a biennial total of $936,000 in Representative McNamara's budget area. And so my question for you is, wouldn't this bill need to go to the Finance Committee that has jurisdiction over those accounts?
Representative Portman, the cost of this bill, should it advance, would be contained in this committee. We've spoken with Chairman McNamara, and he does not wish to hear the bill. He does not wish to hear the bill. The cost of this, should we move forward with this legislation, the cost of this legislation will be carried in the committee target, this committee target for this bill. Representative Hortman.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, then as a matter of how that would operate, would we make a transfer out of one of the funds that's within our budget area to the environmental fund for $936,000 in our budget bill?
Representative Hortman, the specifics of it, we don't know. The committee would have to act on the bill, but the cost would have to be incurred in this committee. So how that could work out, at the end of the day, the dollars are to be paid for in this committee. Representative Horton.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that since this is a fiscal committee, we should talk about the fiscal impact of the bill. We didn't talk about the fiscal note at all. It's a $936,000 fiscal note. And
Representative Hartman, Ms. Hendricks is here and available to answer members' questions, or if you prefer, we can have her do an overview of the fiscal note if you wish.
That would be helpful.
Ms. Hendricks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so in your packet is the fiscal note for this bill. Probably you're familiar with the format. I think I would just point out to you a couple things, highlight a couple of notes in the fiscal note, and then if there's any further questions, I'd be happy to answer those. So perhaps the most helpful would be the final page, page number 3, the table prepared by the PCA that summarizes the cost over fiscal year 16 and 17. So the first line, the estimated cost of one FTE, so that is just the cost for the FTE. Those costs are not added up to the total. But the second line, two FTE to review the EPA plan, to develop the state plan, and this is because of the accelerated development of the state plan, $216,000 in fiscal year 16 and then $220,000 in fiscal year 17. And then a contracting for system modeling or the purchase of licenses, $250,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17 each, which would bring the annual cost to those dollar amounts, $466,000 in fiscal year 16 and $470,000 in fiscal 17, for a total of $936,000 for the biennium. So that is the kind of the summary. If you go back one page, on page 2, you find the assumptions that the PCA has made that lead them to these cost estimates. I think maybe to highlight in the second paragraph, it says, second sentence, to accelerate the development of a state plan, we anticipate the need for two new FTEs. So that's where these FTEs come from. They estimate that that would be true both in 16, fiscal year 16, for legislative approval in for that year, but also going forward as there might be another deadline. Somewhere kind of at the end of the fiscal note, they state that there might be additional cost in the in 18 and 19 if there were additional deadlines to be met. I think that kind of highlights the major assumptions and cost in the fiscal note, but if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my first question then is for the witness, Ben Gerber.
Mr. Gerber, come on down. Go ahead and ask your question. He can multitask.
Okay. Mr. Gerber, you indicated that you have 2,300 members around the state, and I'm wondering if you can outline for me the process by which you determine that your membership would support House File 333.
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, thank you for the question. We have a pretty comprehensive process. What we do is we have policy statements. We actually send them out to all the legislators. I can actually follow up and send those to you, and those are approved by our board of directors, but before that they are actually vetted in policy committees where any chamber member can serve on, vote on the policies. They go to the board of directors, and then we determine what fits within our policies when we're evaluating legislation.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Gerber, in order to determine whether House File 333 was something that your 2,300 members wanted to do or not, you base that on your analysis of the policy statements that they had previously reviewed?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, yes, we do.
Representative Hartman.
And do you know which of your members in particular support the bill and which oppose, and how many of each?
Mr. Gerber.
We don't count, Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, no, we don't count. That's not how we would do it, and we wouldn't reveal specifically if there was something like that.
Representative Hartman.
My last question for Mr. Gerber is, have any of your specific members asked you to come and testify on this bill at the legislature?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, specifically on this bill, no.
Representative Hartman.
I have a question for Mr. Arata, but I can wait.
Come on down, Mr. Arata. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if there are any Minnesota members of the Americans for a Clean Coal Economy.
Mr. Arata.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Portman, I don't know who the Americans for a Clean Coal Economy are.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Arata, what is the name of your organization?
Sir Chairman, Representative Portman, is the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arata, are there any Minnesota members of that organization?
Mr. Arata.
Mr. Chair and Representative Portman, there are no members that are located or have headquarters within the state. There are, however, a number of members who have activities and operations or provide materials and services within the state.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Mr. Arata, you said that Lawrence Tribe, who's a well-known constitutional scholar, opined that the EPA's action here was unconstitutional. You didn't mention, however, he's a paid expert in the case where North Dakota is suing Minnesota. Do you know how much the American Lignite Council or the state of North Dakota are paying Mr. Tribe to espouse that position?
Mr. Arata.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hortman, you may be getting confused because the North Dakota-Minnesota case is not relevant to the Clean Power Plan. They are two separate issues. And no, I would have no idea who has hired him nor what they are paying him.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think as we evaluate bills like this, it's important to look at the Minnesota interest at stake. And so when we cite a constitutional scholar who's being paid by the coal industry in a different state, I don't think that is super relevant to our consideration. I'll pass for now, and you can come back to me after other members have had a chance.
Actually, I'm just going to have you finish up all your questions now before we move on.
Okay, then I have a question for Joel Johnson.
Come on down, Mr. Johnson. And do you have anyone on deck for your questions, Representative Portman?
Lauren Lockhog. I love the bicycle analogy.
So, why don't you guys both come up so that way. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Johnson. Representative Portman.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, did you indicate that all of the power generation used by Minnesota co-ops is generated outside of the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, no, only the generation that is covered under Rule 111D. All of that is located outside of the state.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what power generation would not be covered by 111D?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, GRE's refuse plant in Elk River and the peaking plants located within the state.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then my next question is for Mr. Lawtog. I feel like I'm hoarding the committee's time, though.
You are, but it's okay.
Okay. Mr. Lawtog, I take it that the bicycle was a combined cycle gas turbine plant.
Mr. Chair, Lawtog. Representative Portman, I did use that as an example of building block two, because if you don't own a bicycle or you don't have a friend who owns one can lend it to you, then you're not affected by building block two. I should have mentioned that if you do have a bicycle, you're required to ride it 70% of the days of the year to work for commuting. So the 30% of the days you can drive your normal vehicle to work or wherever you're going.
At this point, the chair will offer a bill for a moratorium on analogies for energy policy. Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, you'll be relieved. My question is not about bicycles. It's about the natural gas combined cycle power plants then. And so is the point that you're trying to make is that Minnesota uses those plants in a certain way that is not conducive to regulation under 111D, if you could focus on the natural gas part of the analogy rather than the bicycle part.
Mr. Lugtug.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, I don't know if I made that point, but others did, that they were really designed for backing up the system. Wind, for example, is an intermittent resource, and MISO dispatches gas units for that purpose. As they progress through the day and through the year, they're very nice at balancing intermittent resources.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those are all my questions for right now.
If you have other questions, you can go ahead and ask them right now.
I might, depending upon the rest of the conversation, I'll let you know.
My polite way of saying I'm not coming back to you if you have more questions. So if you have questions, you should ask them now.
The committee goes till 2:30. We'll just see how it plays out.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, Ms. Hendricks brought up the fiscal note that we did here. I need to ask if the plan needs to be in place by June of 16. How does the fiscal note show a cost for fiscal year 17 of $470,000?
Ms. Hendricks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Fabian, I think, and the PCA is here too to maybe testify to that, but as I understand
it... call them down, Mr. Chair?
Sure. PCA, if you want to come on down.
It says in their assumptions that the new staffing will complete the rulemaking process and development of a proposed state plan for consideration of by the 2017 legislature, so in fiscal year 17, for an additional due date in that summer of 17. So I think the assumption there is that there's two due dates for this plan, both in 16 as well as in summer of 2017, hence the additional cost of these two FTEs in 17.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Frank Kolash. I'm manager of the air assessment section for the Pollution Control Agency. And the explanation that was provided to you, Representative Fabian, is correct. When we wrote the fiscal note, we anticipated that while we have not fully decided yet of whether the second year of plan development will be necessary, we anticipate that it will be. So we wanted to build in the potential costs in the second year if we asked for and received an extension to submit the plan, which would then be due in the summer of 2017 based on EPA's current plan right now.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if that's the case, then, Mr. Chair, with regards to your budget and so forth, how would that be? I mean, at some point, we're going to either be there or not be there, and then how would the other $470,000, if this does not, if it's not needed in that second year of the biennium, how do we spend that money?
Well, Representative Fabian, there are a lot of assumptions in the fiscal note, and without questioning the validity of the fiscal note or going into specifics, I would just simply say that, you know, this is the fiscal note we have. This is the estimated cost for having the legislature approve this plan, and those are the numbers we're going to work off of. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kolash, and maybe it's the question for Ms. Gauthier. I asked Commissioner Stein, I believe, I can't remember exactly when he was here, a week ago or 2 weeks ago, about the position of the administration and Governor Dayton. And I'm asking if there's been any further conversations with the governor's office, if they support the extension that's being reflected in this fiscal note for 1 year.
The testifier? Or...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So, Representative Fabian, your question is, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, your question is the governor aware of the fiscal note and the plan to include a potential cost for fiscal 17 in case that does occur?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to be clear, does the governor support asking for an extension for the date of submission of our state's 111D plan?
The testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian members. Well, since we don't have the final rule in front of us yet, we don't know how long or what it will take for us to achieve our goal. The final rule from the PCA is due late this summer or sometime this summer. So once we get that, then we'll be aware, more aware of where we're going. That said, the bill appears as though it would want it to be considered by the 2016 legislature. So the reason we put in 2017 is that in the event that the state does have to seek a one-year extension, we would be able to provide that additional information.
So why is it that you made an assumption about what legislature would be passing this? What was that assumption?
Mr. Chair, the assumptions that we were making were not based on exactly which legislative session this would be heard in. However, it was representative of the difficulty and the challenges of producing a plan on an accelerated time frame so that we would give the legislature adequate time to hear the plan as it was put together by the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Commerce, and the stakeholders, and also to be able to respond to any requested changes that would come up in that legislative review of the state plan and then still be able to meet EPA's timeline, which right now is a 1 year for a 2016 submittal. Again, we have not decided that an extension would be needed, but we are aware that EPA will provide a 1 year extension, so we would be submitting, certainly having a final plan ready for submittal by no later than 2017.
If that's the case, then why are there greater fiscal costs in fiscal year 17?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal costs are greater because the estimated cost of an FTE goes up in fiscal year 17 versus fiscal year 16.
Representative Fabian, any follow-up?
Not on this point, Mr. Chair, but I do have a couple other questions.
Well, this is your one shot at it.
Thank you. Mr. Arata, Lautug, and Johnson, please. Mr. Arata. You testified that you thought that there would be a 15% annual increase in the cost of electricity to the ratepayers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For how many years is that increase going to take?
Mr. Arata.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, that would be through 2030.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lautug, if this were to be true, can you tell me what the people in Erskine, Minnesota will be paying for electricity in 2030?
Mr. Lautug.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, and that's a kind of, he knows where I'm at with this. So.
Representative Fabian, I've used the example of the Winger, Minnesota.
Okay, I'm Winger, I missed.
Examples, but I can use Erskine if that's in your district, Representative Fabian. We project, we're currently undergoing a refurbishment of our coal plant in South Dakota. That's going to be about a 10 or 15% rate increase. We estimate that the clean power plan would be something like another 15% rate increase. Now, if we, as a result of the plan, have to reduce the capacity factor of Big Stone plant to 23%, which the proposed or the preferred plan would do, then we would also need to purchase replacement power from someone else, so that would be an additional rate increase.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anybody in the room from Minnesota or Rural Electric Association?
Mr. Johnson had to leave for another bill.
Okay.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm representing Minnesota interests here. I think that some of these rate increases, I relayed this incident of that happened to me a month ago in a local hardware store. A local farmer said, Dan, you know, recently we were comparing our electric costs today to what they were just a few years ago. It used to cost us about $400 a month to run our small family farm operation on our homestead with electric costs, and now we're pushing $900 a month. You know, folks, we have to proceed with a lot of caution here with regards to how much we can expect ratepayers to pay for this stuff. You know, Mr. Chair, I've got a lot of questions, and I would like to be respectful of the people's time, so I'll just let her go with that. Thank you.
Representative Baker, then Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to probably direct my questions to the MPCA, if they could come back down, please. And I can make some comments while they make their way down. Again, I sat on the Wilmer Municipal Utilities for about 7 years. I do understand the important issue of this ruling that is anticipated to come down, and I cannot thank Representative Neuberger enough. This is probably one of the most important bills we are going to hear this year. Like a lot of other ones are very important, but this is a big one. And what I heard today was a few folks on the steering committee, which again I applaud the MPCA for putting that together. I think it's a great way to listen and get the stakeholders there. You've got folks on that committee that are saying that it should come back to the legislative for more discussion after a outcome is done with the steering committee. 130 people is a lot of people to try to manage, so I wish you well on that endeavor, because it's going to be a very big process. As I was visiting with the MPCA in my office earlier this month, I was maybe asking the question, why are we as a state and through the MPCA, because I look at the MPCA as sort of being our voice and our fighter for our fairness and for our clean air and clean water, and that is what you're charged to do. But is there a reason why, or is there maybe an approach to allowing this to be a possible system or more fairness that could go through the independent system operator region versus a state footprint, where it could be a little bit more spread out, It could be shared a little bit more. Is that a possibility? Is that something that we can look at differently than or is it just absolutely the EPA doesn't care about that? But I'm just curious if you can make a comment on that.
Mr. Plush.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, EPA certainly recognizes that that is one possibility that they have outlined for how states can comply with this provision. It's important to understand under the Clean Air Act, EPA must give the states an opportunity to develop a state plan. And what they have encouraged and repeatedly stated in the proposed rule was that they encourage states to work on a collaborative, a multi-state, or a regional basis. And that's exactly what the Pollution Control Agency has been doing through a number of groups, at least three groups that we're working with, that include the MISO states, and looking for ways that we can find common ground in order to build state plans. We don't think that it's likely that we can do a multi-state plan the way EPA envisioned it, just because of the difficulties and the politics and the challenges. However, we do think that there's opportunity to have collaboration-ready state plan measures that would allow something like you described or some other similar system that would allow states to manage this and address the compliance issues across a larger region, especially across a footprint like MISO has for the actual market for electricity in Minnesota and other states.
Representative Baker.
To another question. Back in July 2014, our governor had said that he wouldn't mind seeing all the coal plants closed in Minnesota. What does the PCA commissioner think about that statement? Does he agree with that?
The testifier? Either testifier?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Baker, thank you for the question. I would have to ask him. He's not here. Commissioner Stein is not here today, or is neither is Commissioner Thornton.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Hold on, Representative Baker.
Maybe just in a closing statement, I would be very concerned that a person appointed by the governor probably do what the governor wants him to do, he works for the pleasure of the governor, he or she. I think that having an agency that runs a group like our MPCA and having an agency sort of not want to bring the findings of the steering committee back to the legislature should be a real warning sign. I think having an agency have that kind of authority might be very careless on our part. You know, I represent 40,000 people in Minnesota. Everybody in the House of Representatives have about that number. And I would feel like my folks in my district wouldn't have any voice at all after it got through this point if it doesn't come back and have something to say. So I urge our committee to pass this. I think it's an important thing to talk about, but I think our citizens of 5 million plus people in Minnesota need to have a voice at the end of this day. Thank you.
Representative Fabian, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to that point, I would ask the committee, ask the commissioner to weigh in a written form as to what his position is with regards to closing Minnesota coal-fired plants.
Is that available? Can staff do that for us?
Mr. Chairman, certainly.
Thank you very much. Representative Simonson, then Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two quick questions for Representative Neuberger. My first question, and Representative Neuberger, I want to thank you for being open. We've talked about this bill a number of times, and I appreciate that, so thank you. But I'm trying to understand from a practical sense, if the bill as it's currently written was signed into law, I'm envisioning the PCA sending the legislature a plan for our review. And what do you envision specifically would happen? Would the legislature have the authority to amend the plan, or would it be a simple, up-down vote, we approve or we don't approve?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, the way the bill is currently constructed, if you read the language, it's simply a thumbs-up or a thumbs-down approval or disapproval.
Representative Simonson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Neuberger. That's the way I understood it, too, and I just wanted to clarify that point. So if, in fact, the legislature voted it down and that put the PCA back on the hook for essentially reworking the plan, I'm assuming the plan would then have to come back to the legislature for subsequent approval. And how does that affect our timelines with the federal government?
Representative Neuberger, can you cover the hypothetical of if the legislature were to approve it and if the legislature were to deny it?
if the legislature were to approve it, it would go through as we've described. If the legislature was to say no and the EPA would have to go back and amend it again for approval, we're all sent here to do a job. And we're all, if we're given a timeline to get the job done, then we get the job done within the time that we're told to get it done. That includes the MPCA, that includes the legislature, that includes the governor as well. We do this in the best interest of the state and of the people of the state of Minnesota. So we would have to be professional in our demeanor and get it done.
Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott, then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question for the gentleman from the MPCA regarding the fiscal note again. If you would mind coming forward. Thank you. I'm just curious. It seems to me, well, let me just ask this point blank. The computer modeling that is being paid for by this fiscal note, aren't you going to have computer modeling regardless of the time frame in which to get this report submitted back to the EPA?
Mr. Balash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, yes, we will have to have modeling done in order to understand the impacts of any plan decisions that go forward.
However, so my next question would be, why are you making this bill responsible for paying something that you're going to have to pay for anyway?
Mr. Palash.
Mr. Chair, we included those costs into this bill because the accelerated time frame may require multiple runs and extra additional modeling, and understanding which models we're going to use on a faster time frame than the current plan for developing a state plan would anticipate.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that most of this fiscal note is expenses that you're going to incur anyway, regardless of the time frame. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous. And then I have some questions. Thank you. I have some questions for Ms. Hamilton, if she's still here with Fresh Energy. Hi. I'm just wondering, are you registered lobbyist?
Yes, I am.
Ms. Hamilton.
Okay, thank
you. Sorry,
Mr.
Chair.
Thank you. And I'm just curious, has Fresh Energy ever received funding from the Energy Foundation of San Francisco?
Ms. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that concludes my questions at the moment.
Well, this is your one crack, so
I want to give somebody else a
chance. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, quick question for Mr. Kolesh. Again. So Mr. Kolesh, just to be clear, if we don't do a tailor-made plan for the state, then the federal folks will impose one upon us. Do I understand that correctly?
Mr. Kolesh.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. The EPA will impose a federal plan on Minnesota to ensure that all the affected units are covered by the federal regulation.
Okay.
Representative Johnson.
And then last one is just a comment. And on some issues that are so complicated, such as this one, and we heard a rather humorous but strained analogy from Mr. Locktog to try to so us legislators could understand what the heck he's talking about. It seems to me that this is the perfect example where you want a deliberate process of stakeholders to come up with a plan that makes sense in the best interest, public policy-wise, for the state, rather than expecting individual legislators to understand the nuances of this kind of very complicated issue. From a broad 30,000-foot level, I guess we can, but in terms of the nuances, which I hope the stakeholders are dealing on, it seems like the right process to move forward with. So. I would disagree with the bill just from that perspective. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions. The first is probably for Bill Grant, and he's not here, but we could ask him to do this later. But we had a statement from Mr. Kasham that we have a possible saturation of efficiency gains in Minnesota, so we can't make many more. And that was implicit in the remarks of some of the other testifiers. So it seems to me it would be good for us to understand how much inefficiency is actually out there, and we should have some testimony on that at some point, if that would be okay with the chair.
I've solicited public testimony on the issue, and we have the testimony we have. So are you asking me to schedule a second hearing on the bill, Representative Wagenius?
This is a significant bill, and I'm surprised to see that Xcel Energy isn't here, and I would certainly like to ask them how they felt about the bill.
Well, Representative Weakness, they are here.
Well, they haven't didn't put up to testify. Okay. Okay, but that's it does seem to me this is so significant that we should have all of the information that's relevant on the table. And we have two testifiers, or one testifier who directly said we've reached a possible saturation of efficiency in this state, and others implied it. And it seems to me this committee should understand, is that true or not? I do not know the answer to that. I'm not putting that out as something I know the answer to. So that was one thing. But my other questions are for the author, if that's okay.
Yep, go ahead. Representative Wagenius.
As Representative Simonson pointed out, that this bill allows either the House or the Senate to veto the governor's plan. And governor could come up with another plan, and it could be vetoed again, and this could drag out for years. And so the implication of that is that it's not my phone. Implication of that is then the federal government kicks in and says, look, you're not going to do it. We'll do it for you. So instead of that, let's just hear right now, what's your plan? I mean, what is the plan that you are aiming for to significantly reduce carbon in the energy sector?
Representative Neuberger.
Well, Representative Wagenius, we clearly don't have time to go over what my plan is. What I'm going to speak to today is the essence of the bill. And what the bill says is that we, the legislator, who are elected to represent the people of Minnesota, should have the final say in a policy that's going to touch every single citizen in the state and not give the authority to set policy into the hands of bureaucrats. That's the essence of the bill. Now, if you want to discuss other side issues, such as what's my plan, right now I can't pull one out of my back pocket, because right now what is important is what's best for the people of Minnesota. Who should decide our energy future? Should it be an agency with a group of people that are working for them and with them, or should it be us, the people who walked in parades and put up signs and spoke directly to the people that put us here? We're the ones that are elected to represent Minnesota, so that's the job we should do.
Representative Neuberger, does your bill require the legislature to create its own state implementation plan?
No.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
No, it doesn't, and that is part of the problem, because your bill allows procrastination, which then allows the federal government to come in and give us a plan. So it is not out of order to ask you, what is the plan you are aiming for here? And certainly we have time to discuss it. This is a major bill. So of course we should be discussing it. And I want to know what it is. I mean, I can feel very clearly that a lot of the discussion here is about protecting coal. I mean, that's been the whole discussion here. And I am rather startled to hear that our Minnesota policy should be protecting coal. We don't have coal in Minnesota. That is not a resource we have. We have coal to the west of us, but we don't have it. We have wind, we have other renewables. We don't have coal. So, Mr. Chair, this whole discussion only makes sense to me if we're pretending that global warming does not exist.
Representative Wagenius, the bill does not talk about the strength or weakness of 111D. It doesn't talk about whether the courts are going to validate it or not. It's just a matter of who decides. And so on that issue, you and I will have to disagree. Representative Clark.
Very short question for Mr. Arado, I believe it was.
Mr. Arado.
Mr. Rada, you had a slide that showed that officials from 29, 30, and 28 different states had opinions about your position. When you said officials, can you tell me, like, who those officials were? Were these elected officials, appointed officials? Were they? What did officials mean there?
Mr. Rada.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, by officials we mean governors, attorneys general, DEQ commissioners or PCA, depending upon what they are called in the individual state, and utility commissioners. So those numbers that I'm citing came from comments that were filed on the proposal by the EPA that were due December 1st. So those were all state comments. In some states, it was maybe all of those officials got together and filed one set of comments. In other states, they did it differently. It might have been governors only, or the AG only, or the utility commissioners only. So it varied state to state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So were there officials from those same states on the other side of that question?
Mr. Arata.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, I am not sure. I'm sure at least in some instances there may have been. I know specifically in Montana, the Utility Commission would likely have filed comments that would not have been probably completely compatible with what the governor did. I am not the one who reviewed all of those state comments. That was done by our office, and those numbers were put together by folks other than myself. But I have seen a number of them.
So, Representative
Clark. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just interested in trying to get to the bottom of, are these actual state positions, or are they certain people within those states, or, you know, what the category, you know, what it actually meant to have that number. I just thought it was interesting to say officials without indicating who they were. So maybe you have that list. Maybe I could just see your list at some point.
Chairman, Representative Clark, we do have a complete list detailing that state by state, so we'd be happy to provide that.
Thank you.
If you could provide to the committee. Now, members, I have Representative Mahoney as the only person left to talk here, but if there's other members who want to talk, I'm going to recess and we'll come back at 6:30. Otherwise, we're going to finish up and we're going to vote right now. Is there anyone else? Okay, Representative Mahoney, you get the last word.
Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to have a vote on this, but my question is for Representative Neuberger. So, you know, I actually have spent the last couple of years working in a process that brought industry people, stakeholders together to come up with some new ideas and new thoughts on how to do something, and we're throwing that into the hopper, and those bills are moving. So I understand this particular organization that is working on this has industry members, has a Chamber of Commerce, and I do want to apologize to Mr. Gerber. I do listen. I just sometimes choose not to hear. All of these people are invested. We have scientists. We have government agencies. I'm not sure if there's any legislators on this particular group of 50 to 100. So we're trying to move forward with a well-represented group. And I don't know that, as one of the utilities people said, they're the menu, when they probably have 10 or 15% of the representatives there. And that's in essence, a scientific solution to this particular problem. Now, I agree that there are some concerns here. But what your bill does is inject politics into science. And I'll ask the question, do you believe that it's good to inject politics into science?
Representative Neuberger.
Mr. Chair, that's a loaded question that I could probably hit right out of the fence. Representative Mahoney, in our current day and age, that's impossible to separate politics from science, regardless of the scientific issue. If you look at, if you currently, for example, I had asked the commissioner last week if he would supply me and the members of this committee with the list of the stakeholders. I've yet to see that list. Also, there's been much discussion about the fiscal note for this. In my opinion, I think there's some politics going in here. When the fiscal analysts ask, who did they ask? They asked the MPCA to put together this fiscal note, but yet here sits the MPCA testifying against this bill. But yet they're the authority that says this is what it's going to cost. So I've got questions. I've got the same question that you would have. So do I think it's good to inject politics into science? In our day and age, Representative Mahoney, that's impossible because you're going to find it everywhere.
Representative Mahoney?
Well, that's a sad statement. Because
I agree,
when
Mr.
you
Chair.
Hold on, Representative Mahoney.
When you have scientific data in front of you, whether it's as a pipe fitter, and believe me, I kind of like building power plants. I found a few things to do at power plants. But if science comes to us and says, this is 98% of the scientists in the world say this is happening, and this is what we should do to correct it, it's pretty hard. I mean, if you get 125 or 130 members of the House of Representatives to vote on your bill, you kind of go, that's a good bill. I got bipartisan support in one. And the other 2%, well, they just were doing it on principle or silliness. So, and to say that your bill is just a simple up or down vote, I've been around here long enough to see how the legislation can take a simple up and down vote and put conditions in there. There's an old saying around here, we're the legislature, we can do whatever the hell we want, and sometimes we do. So your bill fully injects politics into what is a collaborative group trying to figure out a scientific answer to a problem that we as a state and a nation and as a world are suffering. So I'm going to be voting no on the bill, and hopefully others will join me, but there you go.
Representative Neuberger, any closing comments before we vote?
I'll be brief, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney, what my bill does is it just says we have the ability to vote yes or no on a plan. What would happen, hypothetically speaking, Representative Mahoney, if the plan came back and you didn't like it? If you said that this plan did not meet the scientific criteria that's acceptable to me, you would want a chance to say yes or no to that plan. So what's good for the goose is also good for the gander. There are many other states. We are not alone. We have Arizona. I have a bill that does the same thing. We have Tennessee. We have Pennsylvania. These are just three really good examples that are doing the exact same thing that we are attempting to do here. Again, what this comes down to is should the people of Minnesota have a voice in the electrical future of this state through the people that they elected to be here, or should it be held put in the hands of a few agency people and the people that they're working with? And with that, Mr. Chair, I leave it to you.
I'd like to have we request a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested by Representative Scott. With that, Representative Neuberger renews his motion to have House File 333 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Clerk will take the roll.
Garofalo.
Yes.
Baker.
Yes.
Mahoney.
No.
Clark.
No.
Fabian.
Yes.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hortman.
No.
Isaacson.
Evans, no.
Johnson.
No.
Lunin.
Yes.
Metza.
Yes.
Neuberger.
Yes.
O'Neill.
Yes.
Scott.
Yes.
Simonson. Smith.
Yes.
Swazinski.
Yep.
Vogel.
Yes.
Wagenius.
No.
Let the record show that Representative Isaacson's vote actually counts as 1.5. There being 12 ayes and 7 nays. Sorry, we're not actually going to count the 5. The motion prevails. Members, we are adjourned. Thank you.